remind you that the first 30 people who come tomorrow, which is about Prabhupada's qualities, will get a book to keep, a beautiful little book about Prabhupada's transcendental qualities. But I realize that because we have extra time, that I can start today by telling you a story about Srila Prabhupada, one of my own stories. And that also, this particular seminar includes learning about well-formed plan, because what we're going to be doing over the next 4 days is also be working on some personal plans. And I realized that with the extra time that I could spend a little bit more time teaching about well-formed plan than I had planned. Which means you really get an extra bonus. The well-formed plan seminar, which I teach separately, is an hour and a half seminar. When I studied it, I took 7 hours to learn it. I condensed that into an hour and a half, and I was trying to condense that into 10 minutes, so I will spend a little bit more time on that than I had planned to teach about plants. All right. So you really get it two for the price of one here. So, which story should I tell you? Let's see. I'll tell you the airport story. How's that? Should I tell you the airport story? That's a fun story. I don't like sitting behind this big desk. I mean, I really feel like the big teacher. I'll sit down here. Okay. That is much more comfortable. That's better. Okay. All right. I have to sit up there and look at my notes, but... Oh, by my microphone. Hey, Krishna. All right. So, Prabhupada was visiting in New York in 1975. He was passing through on his way to London. And he was just in New York for 3 days. And maybe some other days I'll tell you some more about when we saw Prabhupada in New York. But I'll tell you the most fun story today. Because you were all so enthusiastic yesterday. So Prabhupada was going to the airport to leave to go to London. And make sure you tell me again if I start talking too fast. I'm so grateful to you yesterday. Thank you so much. So Prabhupada went in one car to the airport. And there was another car leaving with flowers. About 3 or 4 cars altogether. So I also went to the airport. And my oldest son at that time was just a very small baby, a few months old. So somehow or other, the car with the flowers left after Prabhupada, but got to the airport before Srila Prabhupada. Now, in those days, there was no security at airports at all. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. You could even go onto the plane with somebody if you didn't have a ticket. I mean, it was nothing. I mean, you could probably even take a gun onto an airplane. I mean, there was no security. And Srila Prabhupada, because he flew frequently, would go in the airports to a lounge for frequent flyers, a place where there was sofas, you know, couches, and a VIP lounge. So the devotees who got there with the flowers before Prabhupada, I don't know how they did it, they must have been driving very fast, they put the flowers in front of Prabhupada as a path from the front door to the VIP lounge. Now, the VIP lounge in this airport was under construction. So Srila Prabhupada was sitting on the sofa, and he was the only one in the lounge. Nobody else was there. The walls weren't even quite finished. And we all sat there. I don't think there were more than 20 of us there. And I sat down with my baby directly to Prabhupada's left. He was sitting on the sofa, like right here, and I was about as far now as you are from me. It was about that far. I was sitting on the floor with my baby on my lap. And there in the room, Jai Doita, who was then a brahmachari, was there. Kirtananda, Rupanuga was there. Asachabama, who had stayed at my apartment, she came from Gita Nagari, which was just beginning at that time, with her 3-year-old son. She had been making sandesh for Srila Prabhupada. Shalavati was there. And so the first Prabhupada sat down and he was talking. There were many of the devotees that had joined in the very beginning with Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was asking them, you know, how is, like, he asked Shalavati, how are your sons? And he asked Chirtananda, where is Hayagriva? He was asking them, like, intimate questions about people. So I was a little jealous. I thought, oh, they have such a close relationship with Srila Prabhupada. So he was talking very casually like this. And then they brought out a tray for Srila Prabhupada, big, heavy silver tray from the deities. It was about a rectangular tray, about this long, this wide, big, heavy tray, piled high like a pyramid. They must have set this up at the airport with cut fruit. Cut fruit. Fruit that had been cut into all different varieties of fruit, cut into different pieces. And are you translating? Am I going slowly enough for you? Okay. And at the very top was watermelon. So Prabhupada took one piece of watermelon like this. And then he said, distribute. So they took around this silver tray, and everybody just wanted the watermelon. We were all fighting to get the watermelon. And then they brought out another tray, same size, big, heavy, silver, solid silver tray, piled high with milk sweets. I must have taken the devotees at least a week to make all of those milk sweets. I mean, just piled as high as you can imagine. And Prabhupada just looked at it, and he didn't touch it. He just said, distribute. And nobody wanted any of them. Nobody was interested. And then Prabhupada washed his hands. So meanwhile, this Rupanuga, who was our GBC, was having obviously a not very friendly discussion with one of the airport officials in the back of this room. We couldn't exactly hear what they were saying, but you could tell it wasn't a happy discussion. And Prabhupada's looking, and he says, what's the problem? So Jayadvaita says, Prabhupada, they don't like the flowers. They want us to clean up the flowers. So, you know, in those days in ISKCON, we didn't care what the karmis thought. You know, those hogs, dogs, camels, and asses. I mean, who cared? We didn't have any public relations department in ISKCON in those days. So we didn't think about cleaning up the flowers. And so Rupanuga's just arguing with him about why we shouldn't have to clean up the flowers. And somebody said, I don't know who it was, but somebody made the point to Prabhupada, you know, in those days, you could smoke in the airports. Now, at least in America, you cannot smoke any place in the airports. I notice in Europe, they have maybe some room where you can smoke. But in America now, you cannot smoke any place in the airports. But in those days, you could smoke everywhere in the airports. And people, you know, the end of the cigarette butt, after they smoke, they just throw it on the floor. So one of the devotees said, Prabhupada, they don't mind the cigarette butts all over the floor, but they're complaining about the flowers. So Prabhupada told a story, and you might have heard this story before. He told about how his godbrothers went to preach in Burma. And he said that in Burma, they take dead animals, and they bury the dead animal in a container in the ground. And after some years, the animal's body liquefies. And they take this liquid, and they drink it as a very great delicacy. He said, but when his godbrothers went there and they were cooking with ghee, that the neighbors would complain about the bad smell of the ghee. So we were all also laughing. And Prabhupada said, so in the same way, they don't like the cigarette butts, but they're complaining about the flowers. So we were all enjoying it. And then one of the devotees said, Prabhupada, should we have kirtan? Prabhupada said, can we have kirtan? And one of the devotees said, Prabhupada, that will be worse than flowers. Prabhupada said, then we will have very quietly. So a devotee named Sachinandana, who's not in the movement anymore, but I think the BBT still sells tapes of his kirtan. He started playing the mridanga, and Prabhupada played cartels, and he was playing on the side, very quietly, and he had his eyes closed. And Sachinandana started singing Guru Vastika. We sang Guru Vastika, and then Sri Guru Charana Padma. And Prabhupada was also singing. You know, Sachinandana was leading, and Prabhupada was responding. So, I mean, I know this sounds really stupid, and it's not like I didn't already know, but I was sitting right there. I was watching Prabhupada singing, and I was thinking, oh yes, Prabhupada is also chanting to his Guru Maharaj. You know, he's meditating on his Guru Maharaj. So as we were all singing, this is very hard to explain. I mean, I know it sounds funny, and it's hard to put this into words. But we just weren't in the airport anymore, and we weren't in New York, and we were really transported to the spiritual world. I mean, I assume the kirtan lasted about a half an hour, but I don't know. I really just don't know. It was just an absolutely unbelievable, incredible experience. Something beyond, it's just beyond description. I don't know what to say except for that. At some point, and again, I don't know how long it lasted. I mean, from a logical point of view, the kirtan must have lasted a half an hour or so, but I don't know. Now, in those days in the movement, especially in New York, the attitude towards grihasthas with children was not very good. And, you know, I had this little baby, and I started thinking, I should take care of his nappy, you know, and change him. Otherwise, we're going to go to the plane. I mean, I lost my concentration. I started thinking, you know, I should take care of my baby. We're going to have to go to the plane. I should take care of him. And if I don't take care of him now, maybe they'll leave me at the airport, which they might have actually done. And I lost my focus. I lost my attention. So I started putting my son down and rummaging in my bags. Right? So, I mean, I'm right here. I'm like right here, you know, on the sofa. And Prabhupada's right there. And he's there with his eyes closed, playing cartels. I'm starting to take care of my baby, and he had his eyes closed. And then he's still playing the cartels and chanting, but then he lifts up his head like this really slowly, and he opens his eyes, and he turns over, and he just stares at me for a really long time. And, you know, you can't just stop. I don't know, those of you who are parents, I mean, if you're changing a nap, you can't just stop. You leave your child naked, you know, in your lap. And so I had to finish what I was doing, but I felt like kind of crawling into the floor, and I thought, oh no, you know, the Chaitanya Charitamrita hadn't been published, but years later, you know, when I read the story of Srivas Thakur's mother-in-law who disturbed Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's kirtan, I thought maybe that was kind of like me, you know. I felt like I disturbed Prabhupada's kirtan. I mean, he stared at me for about 5 minutes, he's just like staring at me while he's, you know, his kirtan just staring at me and staring at me. So it's nice to get the attention of the pure devotee, but I don't know if that was favorable or not. What was that? I feel really bad. I was just like, I'm sorry, Prabhupada, that I disturbed your kirtan. So then after about 5 minutes, then Prabhupada stood up and he started walking to the gate, and the kirtan continued. We just kept chanting through the airport. And we got to the gate, and Prabhupada goes to get on the plane, and Satyabhama's son, who was 3 years old, he had been saying all morning, I'm going to London with Prabhupada, I'm going to London with Prabhupada. So he runs in to get in line with Srila Prabhupada to get on the plane. And the airport worker, you know, the stewardess goes to stop him, and Prabhupada said, no, he's passenger. So his mother's thinking he has no ticket, you know, he has no passport. She told me later, she was thinking, should I let him go with Prabhupada? What should I do? He's 3 years old, yeah. Anyway, so she took him out of line. But she said even years later, she was wondering what she should have done. Anyway, so later I'll tell you more stories. Okay. I'll see if maybe every day I can tell you at least one. That's a little bonus because they gave us extra time. How's that? Is that nice? Is that okay? Okay. Now I'll come back to the big table where my notes are. So today we're looking at Srila Prabhupada's life, especially Prabhupada's life before he came to the West, and maybe like in the first few months. So if you can think of the significant events, what you consider to be really significant events in Srila Prabhupada's life. Mm-hmm. Or like in the first few months after he came. Yes. Meeting his spiritual master, okay. Yes. Starting back to Godhead. And what? Starting back to Godhead and the Bhagavatam, and the first canto of Bhagavatam. Okay. And by the way, even those of you whose English is not so good, please try to participate, even if you can ask even someone else to translate for you or whatever. The more you participate, the more you'll gain. Yes. Yes. Ah, business failure. That was actually significant because it pointed him in another direction. Yes. Okay. Quit grihastha ashram, sannyas, and move to Vrindavan. Okay. Yes. Oh, it's childhood Rath Yatra. Because then we're going to look at the presentation. We'll see how many that we got. Yes. Mridanga lessons. I don't think that's here. Yes. Yes. Yes, his father really wanted him to learn mridanga. Yes. Yes. Getting on the ship. On the Jaladuta. Is that DH or just D? Just D. Yes. Born in a Vaishnav family. Okay. Yes. Instruction to print books. Yes. Oh, very nice. So seeing family deity worship. Prabhupada referred to that a lot in his preaching. Yes. Getting kichoris. Did he get that from his mother or from his father? From his mother? I think he got puris from his father in the evening. Yes. A spiritual master coming in a dream, telling him to take sannyas, right? Yes. Okay, founding. This is interesting because the presentation we'll see doesn't have some of these things, and it will have some things that we're not mentioning here. Yes? Okay. Choosing book. Yes. Huh? Oh, the person who told him to print books instead of magazines. Okay. That people will keep books instead of magazines, yes? Yeah, okay. Getting free passage. That reminds me of in the Soho Temple in London, there's signs all over the temple offices big signs that say, stop buying things. And when you first read the signs, you think, what in the world? And then in smaller letters underneath it says, get them donated. And I'll tell you, it's actually transformed my consciousness. It really has. It really has. I mean, just recently, my computer printer was struck by lightning. And, you know, I was sitting there thinking, you know, we had this big storm and it was a flash of lightning right over my house. It's hard to call it a house. It's only like 3 by 4 meters big. But anyway, I went, and I had no printer. And I'm there thinking, okay, Krishna, you know, I mean, I need my printer, like today. And then I remembered that sign, you know, stop buying things, get them donated. And I thought, oh, yeah, I know this devotee who works for IBM who told me, Mataji, if you need something, you know, ask me. And I said, well, I'm not asking you for anything now. I thought, oh, yeah, yeah. And I called him, and he said, okay, you know. He said, I can give you up to such and such amount of money. And I thought, well, I don't need such an expensive printer. And then I remembered that my sons were telling me, they said, you know, Mata, you really need to have your own copy machine so you don't have to go in the Gurukul classroom every time you need to make a copy. And one of my sons said, you know, for that donation, you can get a printer that's also a copy machine. But Prabhupada was always thinking like that. Get things. He was always asking, right? For the Fisher Mansion in Detroit. At first he said, will you donate the building? Of course they didn't. But they gave it a very cheap price. I mean, Prabhupada was always asking, will you donate, will you donate, will you donate? So I've tried to get into this mood now, you know. People don't always do it, but sometimes. You'd be surprised sometimes. Sometimes people will donate something worth $1,000, $2,000. If you just have to ask, and sometimes you have to be a little persistent. But yeah, free passage. Okay, anything else? Yes. Oh, his education? Now, Prabhupada in his preaching does refer to things that he learned in his college education. He refers to the ignorance of his professors, and he also refers to things that he learned in the college. Excuse me? Oh, the Gandhi's movement. Yes. Visited Jagannath Puri? Yes. That he visited Jagannath Puri. That made a big impression on him, actually. Although, again, that's not in the presentation here. Yes. The first instruction from his guru to preach in English. Instruction from Guru. Okay, I'm sure there's many more. Let's take a look at this.
You just associate with your devotees, man himself be able to cross over the ocean of nisayas.
Please select a year. Young Abhay was guided by his father in worshipping the deities of Radha and Krishna. He would watch and pray for hours. His devotion to the Lord manifested in his organizing annual festivals, even at an early age. Abhay was tutored at home until the age of 8. He then began public school.
Srila Prabhupada was born on September 1st, 1896, On the day after the anniversary celebration of Lord Krishna's appearance, his father Gaur Mohan Day named him Abhaicharan, meaning one who is fearless because of having taken shelter of Krishna's lotus feet. Young Abhai visited a Radha Krishna temple daily and started to imitate such worship with his own deities when he was 6. When he was 5, Abhai started what became a yearly event, a child-sized version of the great Rath Yatra festival in Puri, Orissa. With the help of his father, he built a cart and had an 8-day celebration, complete with music and distribution of spiritual food. Abhai was tutored at home until he was 8, when he entered Muttilal Sil Free School, which a wealthy Vaishnav had established. He studied there until entering college.
Abhai attended Scottish Churches College, but the knowledge they offered was not what he sought after. During these college years, he became a follower of Gandhi, who always carried the Bhagavad Gita. Abhai married Radharani Datta in 1918.
Abhai entered Scottish Churches College in 1916. He studied English, Sanskrit, philosophy, and economics. Later, when a worldwide preacher, he would sometimes refer to both the truth and foolishness he had heard in college classes. After completing his studies, Abhai decided to refuse his degree, as Gandhi urged all Indians to reject the British educational system. Gandhi's movement had attracted Abhai from the time he entered college. Gandhi, who constantly carried Bhagavad Gita and humbly preached a life of simplicity and austerity, appealed to Abhai's desire to revive Vedic culture. Many of Abhai's fellow students were also favorable to Gandhi and held nationalistic meetings in secret. Abhai married Radharani Datta in 1918. The marriage was a traditional Indian arrangement. Gaur Mohan Day, Abhai's father, had chosen Radharani for his son after considering many eligible young girls. She was young indeed, only 11, though such early marriage was common at that time, and husband and wife remained with their parents for some time after the marriage.
After completing college, Abhai began a career in the pharmaceutical business. At their first meeting, Abhai accepted Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati as his spiritual master. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta taught the truth Abhai had been seeking. In 1923, Abhai and his family moved to Allahabad. It is here that the Kumbh Mela gathering of yogis and sages is held.
Without a degree, getting a good job was difficult. So Gaur Mohan arranged for his son to work as a department manager in the pharmaceutical laboratory of the family doctor and friend, Kartik Bose. Bose's laboratory in Calcutta manufactured soaps, medicines, and other health products. Although Abhai knew little of pharmaceuticals or management, he felt confident after studying some related books. In 1922, when Abhai was 26, he first met his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. A friend had brought Abhai to meet Bhaktisiddhanta, who immediately asked the educated young man to spread Lord Chaitanya's message to English-speaking people. When Abhai asked whether or not India should first gain independence, Bhaktisiddhanta answered that urgent spiritual messages do not depend on political situations. To make more money for his spiritual master's preaching work, Abhai moved from Calcutta to Allahabad. There he became Bose's laboratory's district manager for northern India. Although not yet officially a disciple, he had accepted Bhaktisiddhanta within his heart. So he gradually associated himself more with the members of his spiritual master's organization, the Gaudiya Math. During the Kumbh Mela festival in 1928, Abhai met Tirtha Swami, an important leader in the Gaudiya Math. Abhai was happy to contribute towards opening a branch in Allahabad. A few disciples started a small temple near Abhai's home. After work each day, he would participate in their programs and would bring important people there as well.
In 1930, Abhay's beloved father passed away. The fire of devotion, kindled since childhood by his father, burned with greater intensity as Abhay accepted initiation from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Impressed with Abhay's writing and speaking, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta instructed his editors at The Harmonist to publish whatever Abhay wrote. He instructed Abhay, "If you ever get money, print books." Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati passed away in 1937.
The Day family mourned the passing of Abhay's father, Gaur Mohan, in 1930. Abhay was fortunate to continue to have the association of his spiritual father, Bhaktisiddhanta, who he met again in 1932. Bhaktisiddhanta was touring the holy place of Vrindavan when Abhay joined the group of disciples. Abhay spent as much time as possible listening to his spiritual master speak about Krishna. When Bhaktisiddhanta came to Allahabad to lay the cornerstone for a new temple, Abhay asked if he could become an initiated disciple. During the ancient Vedic ceremony, he received his beads and Brahminical thread. Bhaktisiddhanta remembered his new disciple as one who had been eager to hear his lectures in Vrindavan, and the new initiate remembered his guru's desire for him to preach in English. In 1935, Bhaktisiddhanta instructed the editor of his magazine, The Harmonist, to publish whatever Abhay wrote. For his guru's 62nd birthday that year, Abhay had written a poem which had brought his spiritual master great pleasure, as it showed how Abhay understood his mission. Abhay had written, "Absolute is sentient, thou hast proved, impersonal calamity, thou hast moved." At the sacred lake of Radhakund in Vrindavan, Abhay and his son met with his spiritual master. Bhaktisiddhanta confided to his disciple his worries over his Gaudiya Math society and gave the instruction, "If you ever get money, print books." Abhay wrote his guru in December of 1936, asking if he could do any direct service in addition to giving monetary help. 2 weeks later, his spiritual master replied that he should turn himself into a very good English preacher, which would, quote, "do much good to yourself as well as your audience," unquote. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur passed away from this world on January 1st, 1937. Abhay in Bombay mourned the loss. Yet he knew that by following his guru's instructions, they would never really be separated. Preach in English. Print books.
Taking his spiritual master's instruction to heart, Abhay wrote Introduction to Gita Upanishad and began publishing Back to Godhead magazine.
In 1939, at the age of 43, Abhay wrote Introduction to Gita Upanishad, an English introduction to the Bhagavad Gita. The previous year, he had moved his pharmaceutical business back to Calcutta, where he hoped to generate enough money to publish many English books. He described his work in the Gita as a, quote, "challenge to the agnostics, anthropomorphists, impersonalists, and pantheists." Abhay conceived the idea of an English language magazine, Back to Godhead. In 1944, the first two issues were published. Abhay not only wrote, edited, and typed, but also distributed them. Although he couldn't afford to continue publishing the magazine, he continued to work on essays in Bhagavad Gita. In 1948, the Gita Upanishad manuscript was stolen from Abhay's room and never recovered. It was hundreds of pages representing 2 years of work. It was to have been the beginning of a three-volume, 1,200-page, fully illustrated set. Abhay had even found a wealthy businessman who was interested in financing the publication. Abhay regularly wrote to world leaders, especially in India, urging them to bring society back to spiritual values. He explained how material solutions are insufficient to solve the world's problems. In addition, his godbrother Keshava Swami regularly published Abhay's Bengali articles in the magazine Gaudiya Patrika.
Mm-hmm. Abhay's pharmaceutical business began to fail. In spite of this, he revived the printing of Back to Godhead in 1952. Abhay founded the League of Devotees in Jhansi, but was forced to close the center due to lack of funds. His family, however, was not interested in his spiritual pursuits.
By 1950, Abhay's pharmaceutical business was failing despite all attempts to revive it. He saw the failure as Krishna's indication to put his energy more into direct preaching without trying to finance such preaching through his business. Three of his five children were grown and his family were not very supportive of his spiritual activities. He therefore started to spend much time away from home and business, simply preaching. After 8 years without publishing, Abhay again printed a few issues of his Back to Godhead magazine. As before, he wrote, edited, printed, and distributed it himself. He mailed copies to many of India's social and political leaders and considered sending copies to prominent people abroad. About 100 people gathered to hear Abhay speak about Krishna while he was on a business trip to Jhansi in 1952. Several members of the audience asked him to set up a center for Krishna consciousness there. One doctor offered to arrange for Abhay to meet many locally important people and speak at additional events. Abhay could see that he needed more than publications. He needed a society. He decided to start in Jhansi. The League of Devotees, as Abhay called it in the official charter of 1953, began in the beautiful Bharati Bhavan in Jhansi. This was meant to be the first of many centers of a worldwide organization of Krishna's devotees. Abhay hoped to, quote, recruit members from all nations, creeds, and castes. By the end of 1954, Abhay decided to close the center in Jhansi. Local public officials wanted the building for other purposes. There were no full-time workers, and finances were scarce. But he did not go back to family life in Calcutta. His wife had never supported his preaching work, and now, at 58, he fully took to the retired life of Vanaprastha.
Alone, Abhay continued to publish and spread the message of Lord Krishna in Delhi and Bombay. Abhay then moved to Vrindavan, and in 1959 he accepted the renounced order and was given the title A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami.
These 4 years were spent trying to arrange for publishing and for establishing centers for a society of devotees, but Abhay had no income or institutional shelter. Preaching and seeking donors, he stayed at various places in Delhi, such as friends' homes, a Vishnu temple, and a room at the Kapoor College of Commerce. 8 consecutive issues of Back to Godhead magazine were published in 1956. Still in Delhi, Abhay personally raised the funds, purchased the paper, checked the proofs at the printer, and distributed the copies, often at restaurants or tea stalls. Because most profits went back into publication, Abhay had only enough money for a light cotton jacket and hat in the cold winter weather. Vrindavan, Krishna's birthplace, is not far from Delhi, and Abhay decided to move there. He went to the printer in Delhi every 2 weeks, continuing his publishing and distribution. Abhay also spent months visiting cities such as Bombay and Kanpur to raise funds for printing and to try to revive his organization. And now he also tried to raise funds for a trip to America. Perhaps some Americans were ready to reject the materialism so many Indians were seeking. In Mathura, near Vrindavan, at the Keshavaji Gaudiya Math, Abhay accepted the renounced order of sannyas from his godbrother Keshavaswami. His sannyas title was A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Beyond renouncing family, home comforts, and business, sannyasa was a clear mandate for preaching, an irrevocable commitment.
During his years in Vrindavan, Bhaktivedanta Swami wrote and published several books. He He planned to go west to preach Krishna consciousness. He was determined.
In July of 1962, Bhaktivedanta Swami moved into two small rooms of the Radha Damodar temple in Vrindavan. There he decided to concentrate on writing books rather than magazines, which are often discarded quickly. He therefore started to translate and comment on the Srimad Bhagavatam, the cream of Vedic scripture. Easy Journey to Other Planets, a small booklet, was Bhaktivedanta Swami's first publication other than a magazine. Several prominent Indian scientists and scholars contributed favorable reviews. This booklet and three volumes of the Bhagavatam took shape on a typewriter beneath a light that dangled from the ceiling. Stones held the piles of completed manuscripts in place in the otherwise bare room. Srimad Bhagavatam Volume 1 was published in 1962. Bhaktivedanta Swami had approached Hanuman Prasad Poddar, a religious publisher, who had agreed to donate 4,000 rupees towards his publication. 40 major libraries, universities, and schools ordered a copy. The Ministry of Education ordered 50 books, and the U.S. Embassy ordered 18 copies to be distributed through the Library of Congress. The second volume of the Bhagavatam was published in 1964. An executive of the L&H Sugar Company had donated the 5,000 rupees needed for the printing when he saw the many favorable reviews of Volume 1. Traveling to Bombay, Bhaktivedanta Swami took his two volumes to Srimati Muraji, who was head of the Scindia Steamship Company. She agreed to donate the cost of the third volume. After receiving copies of the newly published Bhagavatam, Prime Minister Shastri wrote to the author, quote, "I am indeed grateful to you for presenting a copy of Srimad Bhagavatam to me. I do realize that you are doing valuable work. It would be a good idea if the libraries and the government institutions purchased copies of this book." Bhaktivedanta Swami now prepared to travel outside of India. Observing that America often set the pace for the world, he proposed to go to New York.
In 1965, Bhaktivedanta Swami found a sponsor for travel to America. Sumati Moraji gave him free passage on one of her cargo ships, the Jaladuta. Bhaktivedanta Swami was to turn 70 on board.
To travel to America, Bhaktivedanta Swami needed a sponsor. He casually mentioned the problem to an acquaintance, Mr. Agarwal, who suggested that his son in Pennsylvania could act as a sponsor. Bhaktivedanta Swami did not know that Gopal Agarwal had signed the sponsorship forms, and so was surprised when the government issued a no-objection certificate. To Gopal, it was a formality he had gone through many times before. No one had ever come. With sponsorship papers and passport, but no money for a ticket, Bhaktivedanta Swami approached one of his Bhagavatam donors, Srimati Muraji. He wanted free passage on one of her cargo ships. At first, she refused to see him, and when finally meeting him, refused his request. "You are too old and will die there," she said. Finally, she agreed to make an arrangement. There was little news coverage of Bhaktivedanta Swami's boarding of the black cargo ship, Jaladuta. Who understood the significance of a renounced saintly person going to America? He carried a trunk of his books, about $7 worth of Indian money, and some dry cereal. He observed his 70th birthday a few days after boarding.
Bhaktivedanta Swami arrived in New York City on September the 19th, 1965. The first month or so, he stayed with his sponsors, the Agarwals, in Butler, Pennsylvania. He then moved to New York and remained alone for 1 year.
A A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami arrived in New York Harbor after 37 days aboard the cargo ship Jaladuta. It was September 19, 1965. While traveling, he had had two major heart attacks. As he collected his suitcase and trunk of Bhagavatams and left the boat, he didn't know whether to turn right or left. A traveler's aid representative directed him to a bus to his sponsor's hometown. Gopal Agarwal, Bhaktivedanta Swami's sponsor, lived in the small city of Butler, Pennsylvania, 500 miles west of New York. For 1 month, Bhaktivedanta Swami stayed at the YMCA, cooked at the Agarwals, and gave some lectures about Lord Krishna. Then he got an invitation from Dr. Mishra, who ran a yoga studio in New York City. Dr. Mishra, an impersonalist, didn't want his guests to discuss philosophy with his students, but it was a place to stay. In April of 1966, a friend offered Bhaktivedanta Swami a loft to share with a hippie in the Bowery of New York, a skid row of bums and drunks. Most acquaintances advised against the move. But when he settled on the Bowery, the hippies in nearby Greenwich Village heard about him and started to attend his morning and evening classes. Bhaktivedanta Swami continued to work on translating the rest of Srimad Bhagavatam.
After a brief period of residence on the Bowery, he moved to 26 Second Avenue. There, he began a program of worship and teaching.
Bhaktivedanta Swami had to leave the Bowery loft because of the craziness of his roommate, who often took LSD. The situation was so dangerous that he left his things in the loft and ran to a public phone to call one of the regular visitors to his classes. Several of his well-wishers combined resources to rent the Swami a storefront and mirror apartment at 26 Second Avenue, a part of New York's Lower East Side. A sign announcing Bhagavad Gita classes was in the window, over which remained a prophetic sign left from when the storefront had been a curiosity shop, Matchless Gifts. The hippies came to hear Bhaktivedanta Swami chant the Hare Krishna mantra and explain the eternal philosophy of the Gita. Here were interested young people. Many of them came regularly. On July 6, with the help of those who attended his programs and even a lawyer who volunteered his services, Bhaktivedanta Swami legally incorporated the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, ISKCON. ISKCON was created, quote, to systematically propagate knowledge to society at large and to educate all people in the techniques of spiritual life in order to check the imbalance of values in life and to achieve real unity and peace in the world. Lifetime vows to abstain from illicit sex, meat-eating, intoxication, and gambling, as well as to chant the Hare Krishna mantra 16 times around 108 beads daily were demanded of a disciple. A small group of regular followers took such vows at a replica of an ancient Vedic fire sacrifice. The seed of devotion to Krishna was planted in America.
It was here that he founded the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, ISKCON, and held the first initiation ceremony.
Anything particularly you'd like to add to this list after seeing that little review? Yes? Okay, the heart attacks on the ship. Anything else? Yes. Oh, the poem. Oh, that was really significant, wasn't it? That his guru said that whatever he writes should be printed. Print what he writes.
Yes.
Yes, the manuscript stolen. We mentioned that yesterday as an obstacle. That was a pretty big obstacle. I mean, nowadays with computers, if someone steals your manuscript, hopefully you have a backup on a disk, you know. But I mean, if your typewritten manuscript is stolen, that's pretty major. Something else after watching that you can think of? Yes. Okay, difficulty with illness. The long-term lack of family support. You know, when Srila Prabhupada speaks about leaving his family, his final decision to leave his family, of course, it was an ongoing problem with his family not supporting him. But Prabhupada talks about it being not such a simple thing. You know, he said he came home for lunch, for prasadam, and the way he tells the story was that the cook had been sick. You know, in many Indian households, people have a hired cook, and the cook had been sick, and his wife had become so spoiled, as the way Prabhupada tells the story, that when the cook was sick, she didn't cook. That she bought non-devotee food. And she didn't have any money, so she traded one of his bhagavatams. So Prabhupada was upset that she was so lazy that she wouldn't cook, that she bought non-devotee food, and that she bought it with a bhagavatam. Those three things. All right, what I'd like for us to spend the rest of this time doing, oh boy, we don't have a whole lot of time, is to go over what is a well-formed plan. So then we can come up with some plan as to how we can better glorify Srila Prabhupada's life. Because, I mean, right now, if you ask most people, you know, who's one of the most important heroes on the planet right now? I mean, how many people would say Srila Prabhupada? Not very many people. Right? I mean, they tell you whoever the heroes of Belgium are. I'm sure we probably have people here from at least 15 different countries. So you've each studied the heroes of your own country, at least in order to pass the exams. I don't know if you still remember. And there's some statues in the capital city. Well, this is a hero, that is a hero. Prabhupada said one day this movement will be known for saving the world. But it wouldn't it be nice if we could let people know about Srila Prabhupada's life? Now, of course, there's been some attempts. Like Bhakti Chiruswami has made this video. Of course, he's directed this primarily at an Indian audience. That's been his mission, his vision with that. But we don't have to limit ourselves to that. So what I'd like is to hope that each of us can have some plan to glorify Srila Prabhupada. But if we're going to have a plan, it should be a well-formed plan. Does that make sense? It should be a plan that's likely to succeed. Okay. So the first thing, if we're going to have a plan that's likely to succeed, is that it should be stated in the positive. All right. I'd like all of you here, you can think about anything you want, anything at all, doesn't matter what it is, anything except a blue elephant. What happens? Isn't that funny? Yeah, you thought about a pink elephant, huh? If we just simply think about what we don't want, we tend to get that. So if you put your plan in the negative, do all of you have the handout for well-formed plan? Does everyone have the handout? You don't have? Are there any more? Did they all get passed out? If we ran out, you'll have to share. There's some more? Okay. So the problem is that we get what we want. I mean, we know this happens at the time of death, right? Yam yam bapi sram bhavam twaja chante kalevaram tam tam evaiti kanteya sadasad bhava bhavita. Whatever we think about at the time of death, that's the body we get. But this happens even during life. What we think about is what we get. So if I think, I don't want to be angry, 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 then I'm not going to eat any more sweets, I'm not going to eat any more sweets. What are we thinking about? Sweets, 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 sweets. So how do we become detached from Maya? We think about what's bad with Maya, that's true. I mean, they're like the, you know, forest of material enjoyment. I mean, think about that. But our main way of becoming detached from Maya is to become attached to Krishna. Satchinandan Swami was talking about that. How do we control our senses is we get them filled up with Krishna. If our senses are filled up with Krishna, then there's no room for Maya. And Prabhupada said, the cup is filled up with milk, then you can't put any ink in it. So if we think about what we want, then automatically we won't get what we don't want. So you don't just say, I don't want to be proud. I want to be what? I want to be humble. The question you ask is, what do I want instead? So if we're going to think, how do I want to glorify Prabhupada's life? Any plan. The first point is it has to be stated in the positive. First point, it has to be stated in the positive. Okay? The first two points in the well-formed plan are the most important. If they're not there, just forget about the rest of it. Right. The next point is it has to be under your personal control. So you don't want to have a plan that, well, this is what the GBC ought to do. This is what the temple presidents ought to do. Because can you control anybody else? No. What happens if you have a plan that depends on what somebody else does? You'll become what? Very frustrated. You know, I have a plan that my husband, my wife, my neighbor, my temple president, whatever, is going to be nice to me. What do you get? Frustrated. Right? The only person we can control, barely, is ourselves. Right? So the plan, first, the two things, it has to be stated in the positive and under our personal control, something that we can do. Right? And I give you an example there of a good plan and a bad plan. Right. Then the next thing is that it has to be specific. If I just say, well, I'm just going to go tell everybody about Prabhupada, it's not specific enough. I'm just going to go preach. Or I just want to be humble. Well, how specifically? And the specificity has to be three areas. And Prabhupada talks about thinking, feeling, and willing. And that means we're talking about thoughts, emotions, and actions. So when I make a plan, it's got to be specific. What am I going to do? What am I going to think? And how am I going to feel? So if I say I don't want to eat sweets, what am I going to do instead? Okay, well, when the big plate of sweets comes along, what am I going to do? What am I going to think? How am I going to feel? Instead. You know, I don't want to be arrogant. Instead, I want to be humble. Okay, well, what does a humble person do? What does a humble person think? How does a humble person feel? But pretend, if I were humble, what would I do? What would I think? How would I feel? It's as specific as possible. So if I'm going to have a plan to glorify Prabhupada's life, what specifically will I do? What specifically will I be thinking? How specifically will I be feeling? It can't just involve actions or just involve thoughts or just involve emotions. It's got to have as much specificity in these areas, the better. Without specificity, it won't happen. Okay, but remember, unless it's in the positive and under your control, there's no point in being specific. There's no point in being specific about a negative plan. And there's no point in being specific about a plan that's not under your personal control. So don't even think about specificity unless you've got a positive plan that's under your personal control. Okay, then the next thing is time, place, and circumstance. So I have a specific plan. Let's say you have a plan you want to be humble. Do you want to be humble in all circumstances? If someone attacks the Harinam party, do you want to be humble? Or do you want to be humble in the same way as you want to be humble in other circumstances? If I'm going to have a specific plan to glorify Srila Prabhupada's life, who's my audience? Am I going to have this plan directed at the people in my country, in another country? You know, to what kind of people, in what circumstances, in what place, under what conditions? Because what's going to be interesting to one type of person, like we distribute prasadam. We distribute some prasadam in restaurants. We distribute prasadam at Sunday programs. And we distribute prasadam at Food for Life. It's quite different. The way we're distributing prasadam, everything, the presentation is very different. So the more specificity you can have there, the better. And finally, and this is also very important, your plan has to be in harmony with your life. So someone says, "Wow, okay, starting tomorrow, I'm going to get up at 2 in the morning. I'm going to chant 64 rounds a day, read Prabhupada's book 6 hours a day." And probably that isn't in harmony with your life. Right? Or one devotee was telling me that in order to finance one project, she would have to turn over all of her earnings, and then she and her husband would have to give up their apartment, and, you know, maybe they'd have, their whole family life would be destroyed in order to finance this one project for Prabhupada. So that's not in harmony with your life. If in order to do this project, you know, your health falls apart, your sadhana falls apart, your husband or wife divorces you, your child is neglected, everybody hates you because you become so nasty because you don't get any sleep anymore. So that's not in harmony with your life. And if we make a plan that's not in harmony with our life, generally what happens to that plan? We don't do it. It doesn't work, or we don't do it, and then we just say, oh, that doesn't work. Okay, some questions about this. In what way was Prabhupada's plan not under his personal control? Well, the aspects that he could plan were, he planned to come, you know, his own part of the plan, I plan to come to America and I plan to preach. I mean, ultimately, it's up to Krishna what he's going to do. But you can make a plan for what you're going to do. But that's a very good question. In other words, I can't make a plan and say, the way I want to glorify Srila Prabhupada is I want to convince my temple president to put on a grand festival for Vyas Puja. Because I can't control that. I can say, I'm going to organize a festival for Vyas Puja, if I can organize it. Now, let's say that I need help. Well, what can I do to try to get help? Can I inspire people? Do I have friends I can talk to? Do I have people I can go to help organize it? You know, what can I do? Even if I'm dependent on getting other people to help, what's within my own sphere of control and influence that I can do to try to get that help? I can make a plan to try to get help. I can say, all right, this is what I'm going to do to try to get help. Does that make sense? Well, I can say, all right, I would like to do such and such. To do such and such, I need some help. So then I step back and I say, all right, I'm going to do a plan to get some help. What is under my control? What's under my control then is to call a meeting to get some help. Then I step back. That's a very good question. I say, okay, organizing the festival is not within my control, but calling a meeting to ask for some help, that becomes my plan. I go back a step. If I need to do something that requires $10 million and I'm not Bill Gates, well, then what is within my control? Can I approach some people? Can I do some fundraising? Can I talk to some devotees who are expert in fundraising? What can I do? I say, okay, what's the step before that I can do? What is within my control to do? Very good question. It's an excellent, excellent question. Any other questions on this? Because I'd like us to actually do something before we end here. But if you have other questions, ask them, please. No? Okay, if anyone needs paper or pencil, there's paper and pens there. What I'd like us to do is think about a plan and be creative. Although it should be something that you can do, please be creative. Do remember that Krishna also accepts devotional service offered with a subtle body. And even if the plan that you think of for how we would spread the glories of Srila Prabhupada's life never happens on the gross platform, that you sit here within 10 minutes, these 10 remaining minutes that we have, and think of what you would like to offer to Srila Prabhupada is still accepted. So I do invite all of you, you can work with the person next to you, you can work by yourself, and think about that we would like for the world to glorify Prabhupada as much as they glorify, you know, Gandhi and Mother Teresa and Winston Churchill and all the people that they glorify in the world. Yes? You don't have to. The only thing you have to do is exist and serve. Well, Krishna's in control, but Krishna is so pleased when you think of some way to serve him nicely. Prabhupada said, the way we conquer our plans to try to be happy in this world is to make a plan to spread Krishna consciousness. All of us have the propensity to make plans to be happy in this world. That's part of our conditioned nature. And we conquer that not by stopping, not by just saying, okay, I'm not going to make any more plans to be happy. But by starting to plan, how are we going to spread Krishna consciousness? Of course, it's up to Krishna. But just that we express that desire is pleasing to Krishna, even if it doesn't happen. And who knows? Maybe one of your plans will happen. I'm hoping it will. I'm hoping everyone's plans happen. I'm hoping that all of you make some wonderful plan for how we could glorify Prabhupada's life and that they all happen. Who thought Prabhupada's plan would happen? Who would have thought? Who would have thought in 1942, from what we just saw today, from the presentation we saw, if you had met Prabhupada in 1942 or 1952, would you have dreamed? Compare what we saw yesterday and what we saw today. From a material point of view, would you have imagined? Is it possible? Materially, is it possible? No. Think of a plan. Okay? Please. You don't have to. But I think you'll be happy and Krishna will be happy. Be creative.